And it's been more than a month since the horrific video of George Floyd's killing inspired a movement demanding change in policing, in education, in the symbols we wear, and the statues many took for granted, the way we feel. All good, but why now? Why are people suddenly paying attention when injustices against Black and Brown Americans have been tolerated for years? Why not after the protests of other deaths, of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, for instance, so many others? Well, according to Stanford psychology professor Jamil Zaki, it has to do with empathy, how it's fostered, and what makes it atrophy, just like a physical part of us might. Zaki is author of The War for Kindness, Building Empathy in a Fractured World. We spoke with him earlier this year. He was teaching kindness and empathy to college students immersed in technology and social media. Professor Zaki, Jamil, good to have you back.
It's great to be back.
And it was fascinating to read some of your writing about empathy. For instance, you say it is like a muscle. And we were remembering when we did a story on how will, which you don't think is a tangible thing, you know, your will to stick with a diet or to work out, your will is actually a muscle. How is empathy like a muscle?
We tend to think of a lot of features of our inner lives, like how outgoing we are or how empathic we are, as just something that will never change, something that you either have or you don't. But it turns out that empathy is like a skill. It's like a muscle. We can practice it like any other skill and get better at connecting with people, which is terrific in some ways, but also has a dark side. Because like a muscle, if you don't use it, it can, as you say, atrophy.
Yeah. By the way, I think we should learn the distinction between empathy and sympathy. How are they different?
Oh, thank you so much for that question. It's so important to define our terms. Empathy, as psychologists see it, is an umbrella term for multiple ways we connect with other people's emotions, including at least three things. One is sort of catching or sharing what other people feel. A second is trying to understand what they feel and why, which we would call cognitive empathy. And a third is feeling concern for what other people are going through and a desire for them to feel better, which is what we would call compassion or empathic concern. And all three of these can change depending on our experiences, practices, and habits.
And that brings us to the relationship between power and empathy. You say it's an inverse relationship. The more powerful people are, the less likely they're to have empathy, because they're less likely to need other people. Flesh that out.
Yeah, so a lot of this comes from the great work of the psychologist Michael Krauss. Michael and his colleagues argue that, you know, a lot of people, whether they come from lower socioeconomic backgrounds or from underrepresented groups, they face all sorts of disadvantages, from material insecurity to the danger of being disenfranchised or even facing violence at the hands of the state. And all of these disadvantages and vulnerabilities just make it obvious how much people need each other. And as a result, people who are lower in status and power tend to practice or work on their ability to understand other people and get better at it. By contrast, people with relative power might be less inclined to realize that they need other people and therefore less inclined to work on understanding them. And that pops out in all sorts of different ways. So Michael and his colleagues have found that people who are high versus low in power and status are less likely to be able to understand other people's emotions. Their heart rates don't match up with other people. When they're in conversation with a stranger, they're more likely to look disinterested, for instance, not making eye contact. And they report lower compassion for the suffering of other people.
Well, there's science here. I mean, science that shows that, for instance, lower status individuals pay more attention to facial cues. They can see when somebody's upset, and somebody who's, you know, much higher status, you know, just isn't reading the cues.
I think that's right, Robin. And, you know, let's go back to the idea of a skill. So why do you, or why do I, or why does anybody work on a skill? It's because we realize that it's important to us. And again, it seems, based on the research, that in essence, people who are lower in status just realize that the skill of connecting with others will be very important for them to make it, because oftentimes they don't know if they have the resources to make it on their own. And so it's that recognition of the need for others that drives us to practice something, right, like empathy, which in turn builds that muscle, builds that skill. And that's one of the sad things, is that people who have a lot of privilege could make a difference. They can affect lots of people with their words and actions. And yet it's these very people who often have blind spots to the experiences of the folks who they could help the most.
Yeah. And you know, we asked at the start, why is this happening now? Why do polls show a huge majority of Americans from different parts of the country and both political parties feel that there's been injustice and there's systemic racism? That's so different from other times. And research shows that, you know, in our past, in our recent history, whites have a reason not to understand some of our terrible past, because that might force them to realize that they might have contributed or benefited from it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So, you know, you can go back to, again, maybe people with less privilege and power have lots of motivations, lots of reasons to practice this skill. Well, people with privilege might have reasons not to, because focusing on the pain of others might make them focus also on the ways that they're benefiting from the very systems that cause others harm. When someone feels that they are the culprit for the harm of somebody else, that's a threat to them. We want to view ourselves as good people. And when you're forced to see yourself as a perpetrator or as part of a group of perpetrators, that damages your ability to continue seeing yourself as good. And how do people react to that? They strive for any means through which they can recover their sense of being a good person. And unfortunately, one of the most effective ways to do that is to blame victims or to dehumanize them. There's a really dramatic example of this. My colleague Al Bandura studied in executioners and other death workers. And what they found is that people who were responsible for executing folks were more likely to dehumanize those prisoners. And the level of dehumanization tracked how involved in the prisoner's death somebody was. The idea here is that when empathy threatens us, we might purposefully turn it down. So in one set of studies, psychologists reminded white Americans about the slaughter of Native Americans at the hands of Europeans. And in response to this, white Americans tended to dehumanize Native Americans, or view them as less capable of experiencing the full range of human emotion.
And in so doing, atrophying that muscle. But as you say, you can go to the gym, you can go to the empathy gym, you can work it. How do you do that?
Well, I think that there are lots of ways to do it, but let's first stipulate that it can be done. I think there's a lot of thinking in this space and a lot of reporting on this privilege empathy gap that suggests that privileged people have brain damage or are incapable of empathizing. And A, that's unnecessarily hopeless. B, it lets powerful people off the hook. It says, well, they just can't do it. They can. Anybody can. And one clear way of doing this is by just practicing on a regular basis, taking the perspective of others. Research from Adam Galinsky, for instance, has found that when people who are in positions of power do regular perspective-taking exercises, they're more open to justice. So oftentimes in settings like conflict resolution, the idea is, let's have each party have equal time. But it turns out that there's a more powerful way to do perspective-taking when there are pre-existing imbalances of power. Because people in disadvantaged positions tend to already know a lot about the perspective of those in power. In our case, sort of a wealthy white male perspective. So my friend Emile Bruneau did a really powerful set of studies where he basically said, instead of ignoring power differences, let's flip them on their head. Let's have people from historically lower power groups play the role of the perspective giver. And let's have people from higher power groups play the role of an active listener. That type of exercise that really, again, reverses and in a way redresses old imbalances in power actually produced greater harmony between groups and greater affiliation between them.
Well, so that's one way. You were telling us other ways that, you know, we can work that muscle.
Well, I think one especially important way to think of now is by diversifying the voices that we have in our life and in our culture. I think right now, thanks in large part to the work of activists and in particular work within the Black community, a lot of people who have relative privilege have opened their eyes more so, as you said, than during previous movements, even 4 or 5 years ago. Now, one thing about empathy that's tricky is that it's hard to count on it to last. And the problems that we're facing as a culture aren't just problems of empathy, they're problems of structural racism and inequity. But one thing that I think we can do is use the empathic momentum we have to make sure that we're creating policies that put Black and brown voices in positions of leadership and in high-profile positions in our culture. Because one way to practice empathy is to hear from people who are different from you on a regular basis.
Jamil Zaki, professor of psychology at Stanford University, author of The War for Kindness, Building Empathy in a Fractured World. He also taught a class on kindness at Stanford. We'll link it to our past conversations. Professor Jamil, thank you so much.
Thank you.